Welcome to the Hoopsite Podcast. My name is Alex Kennedy. Just a reminder, we post new episodes every Monday and Thursday. We recently did interviews with Mark Cuban, Sean Marion, Greg Oden, Rashawn Holmes, and many others. So check those out and subscribe. Today I'm joined by Ben Cohen, who's a sports reporter for the Wall Street Journal and author of the new book, The Hot Hand, The Mystery and Science of Streaks, which is on sale now. Ben, thanks for joining me. How are you?
Thank you for having me. I am doing very well right now.
So I have to say, before we get into this book and kind of discuss the writing process and everything that's in it, I have to tell you, I was super fascinated with this book. I couldn't put it down. I'm not just telling you that either because you're here. I really loved it. And I think even if you're not a basketball fan, this is so interesting because you pull from real life examples of streaks and finding patterns in randomness and mention things like Spotify and Hollywood and paintings. I mean, the art world. It was so interesting. And I just want to tell you that before we get started, I think you did a fantastic job on this book.
Well, thank you so much. And I am glad that the check that I sent to you arrived in the mail. So so I appreciate those very kind words.
I love it. This is your first book. So how long did it take you to write this? And what was that process like?
That is an excellent question. I wrote a few stories about the hot hand for the Wall Street Journal a few years ago. So the first one was in 2014, and the second one was in 2015. And I kind of sensed right away that there was a book here, in part because these really smart people had studied the hot hand for a very long time. They had done it through basketball, but the reason they were doing it was because they were not really studying basketball, right? This was a phenomenon that applies widely beyond basketball and touches, I think, pretty much everybody on earth. And so that was kind of irresistible to me. And I sensed that there was something here. I really started writing it in earnest around May 2017. And it took about 18 months, 2 years to finish it. And so somewhere between like 3 years and 5 or 6 years, which is slightly longer than I usually take for a story in the Wall Street Journal.
You wrote about experiencing the hot hand at one point when you played high school basketball. I had a similar experience, which is why it was so hard for me to believe the hot hand didn't exist. I think anyone that's kind of felt that immediately starts questioning everything and thinking, is everything I know wrong whenever they're told that the hot hand isn't real? So because you kind of had that experience going into this process, did that kind of make you doubt the original paper that said the hot hand isn't real? And how did that kind of inform your opinions?
It actually just made me even more blown away by the original paper in 1985 that is this classic paper in the canon of behavioral economics. And what makes it this classic paper is the conclusion, which is that there is no such thing as the hot hand, right? This was so unbelievable that many people just refused to believe it when it came out. It was published by these three brilliant psychologists named Tom Gilovich, Bob Ballone, and the great Amos Tversky. And it was this easily digestible example of seeing patterns in randomness. It was this cognitive bias that we could all relate to. And yet, like, we just couldn't wrap our minds around it. Even when they asked other basketball players, do you believe in the hot hand? Even when they had said that there was no such thing as the hot hand, they continued to believe in it. And that's sort of where I was. I had my own brush with the hot hand. The one time in my life that I was not completely terrible at basketball, it was in a JV basketball game my sophomore year of high school. I scored more points in one quarter than I had in my entire career combined. And there was just something strange about that day. There was something different. And I still don't really understand what happened, but it stuck with me for a very long time. And I think that's what tends to happen with the hot hand. And I think it's why we are all familiar with that feeling, because it does linger with us. So, you know, when I first read this paper that was published in 1985, it was mind-boggling to me because I had never even stopped to consider that there was no such thing as the hot hand, right? Like, it wasn't a question in my mind. Of course there was. I had felt the hot hand. I had seen the hot hand. We all have if we've watched the NBA. And so I think that is what made the paper so irresistible to so many people for such a long time, because it questioned something we all felt and saw and would have sworn to be true.
Right. And can you kind of talk about that original study, what it entailed? I know that it was in 1982 and, you know, they went and met with the Philadelphia 76ers, talked to them, had them shoot different shots and predict whether or not they were going to make the shot before, you know, they attempted it. And they also analyzed some of the stats from that season. And they found that when players make three shots in a row, they shot the ball worse than they did when they missed several shots in a row. So it really basically proved that people just see patterns when they're not there. At the time, that was the thought. Can you kind of give more detail and talk about what that study entailed?
Yeah, the study started with the Philadelphia 76ers. So it wasn't all that long ago, but given everything that we know about the NBA and data and how basketball works today, it feels like a very long time ago. So the only person who actually kept shots in the order in which they were taken was the statistician for the Philadelphia 76ers. His name was Harvey Pollack. He was called Superstat. He was kind of this towering figure in the world of analytics before, you know, analytics was even a word in the NBA, right? And so now we know, you know, everything you could possibly want to know about a given shot in the NBA. We know who takes it, where it's taken, where the defender was. Like, you know, we know a lot in granular detail. But back then we knew almost nothing. And the very little that we did know came from the Philadelphia 76ers. So these psychologists were able to get the Sixers data. And what they did was they actually studied the chronology of these shots, and they tried to figure out, if you made a few shots in a row, were you more likely to make your next shot? Because that's really what the hot hand is thought to be, right? Like, you feel like you can't miss after you've made a few shots. You're on fire. And what they found when they actually looked at the data was that it simply wasn't true. It was our minds playing tricks on us. And as if that weren't enough, which it would have been, it's this incredible counterintuitive, delicious finding. Like, you could want nothing more if you are an academic researcher. They polled the 76ers. They polled basketball players at Stanford and Cornell. They looked at free throws from the Boston Celtics. Every piece of evidence at the time suggested that there was no such thing as the hot hand. It was this figment of our imagination. And no matter how much we believed in it, that didn't make it any more true.
Over the years, other researchers argued that the sample size was too small and really challenged these findings, but it wasn't until Carolyn Stein and John Eskowitz used SportView data to help prove that there is a hot hand. They basically found that when players were hot, there was a 1.2% improvement for players who made one of their past four shots, and a 2.4% improvement in field goal percentage when they made two of their last four shots. So can you talk about those findings? And because that was the first time I'd ever heard that. I had heard of this original research paper and people saying the hot hand wasn't real. And again, I was kind of shocked, but I thought, oh, wow, you know, they're smarter than I am. So what do I know? I just thought it was real. And I was skeptical, but I hadn't heard about these changes in recent years where they did, in fact, prove that the hot hand is real. Can you kind of speak to that change?
Yeah, I mean, what's changed in recent years, and this is really why I wrote the book, is that we have this new evidence powered by this new data, and in some cases, new ways of thinking about these very old problems that suggests that our intuition about the hot hand may have been right all along, and it might actually exist. And, you know, ever since the first paper about the hot hand in 85 came out, there have really been hundreds of studies that came along afterwards and tried to poke holes in that paper. And for the most part, that paper held up. Now, you know, everything that we know from psychology and economics and all types of social sciences from the 70s and 80s, you know, sometimes they just don't hold up. Sometimes there are problems with the reasoning, but also sometimes there's just problems with data, right? We have much better data now than we did back then. And that is sort of the case with the hot hand. I mean, what Carolyn Stein and John Eskowitz and Andrew Boskoski, who wrote this paper, were able to do was get data that Gilovich, Vallone, and Tversky were not able to imagine in like their nerdiest, wonkiest, wildest dreams. They were able to get access to SportView data right after those high-resolution tracking cameras were introduced to a bunch of NBA arenas. And the reason that those SportView cameras are so useful for thinking about the hot hand is because they're able to show exactly what every shot is like, right? They are this picture of the shot that we were never able to see before. And so they could tell you who was taking the shot, of course, but they could tell you where the shot was taken and where the defender was and how difficult the shot was. That's what these researchers really did. They were able to show that when you felt hot, you took more difficult shots. You took longer shots and crazier shots and riskier shots. Now, we all know that feeling, right? We've seen the NBA. We've seen players throw up heat checks, shots that they never would have been able to take if they didn't have this built-in excuse, which is that they were hot. However, For as long as we have been thinking about the hot hand, we had never been able to take into account that shift in probability, right? Like if you make three shots in a row, you are taking shots that are less likely to go in, most likely. And once they were able to control for the shot difficulty, they showed that there really might be such a thing as a hot hand. It's a small effect. It's not like the exaggerated fireball of NBA Jam that we might have in our minds, but it shows that maybe we weren't so crazy to think that this thing that we had all felt and seen could actually be real.
And then there was also researchers that came forward and said that there was some really interesting faults with the initial paper, and it's very complicated, and I would tell anyone to read the book because it's very complex, but essentially they found out that there were certain things missed in that process, and that initial paper actually proved that there is a hot hand, and there was a fallacy of a fallacy involved, essentially, and that if you actually look back over those findings, when players got hot, their shooting percentage actually improved by 12 percentage points. Can you kind of speak to those findings? It seemed like, you know, the study had actually proven that the hot hand exists. It just took 30 years for someone to realize it.
Yeah, it's incredibly ironic. Now, this paper was written by two young American economists in Europe named Josh Miller and Adam Sonherjo. And what they found was just trippy. There's really no other word for it. It's kind of mind-blowing. And they found a very, very, very subtle statistical quirk. So subtle that like many of the world's brightest statisticians had looked at it and missed it. It had been hiding in plain sight for about 35 years until they came along and found it. And it really flipped our understanding of the hot hand on its head, because it suggested that the hot hand fallacy, the idea that it was not real, that itself was the fallacy, which is really nuts. And as a writer, it made for a really fascinating story. And so, you know, I do have to say, though, like this first paper from 1985 has been called into question, but I still find it hugely admirable. I mean, it found something really interesting about the way our minds work. And I think probably directionally, it's true. Like the hot hand is not what we think it is. Now, does that mean that there is no such thing as the hot hand? Does that mean that we shouldn't listen to like professional basketball players when they swear that they are elevating to this higher plane and that there really is something going on? Maybe not. But, you know, I do think it's worth reading that paper and thinking about the lessons of them, because they still apply, I think, in a lot of ways.
I totally agree with you. You know, we still see that people see patterns in randomness. They spot patterns when they aren't there. And one example of that is when Spotify made their shuffle, and you talk about this in the book, they basically had to make it less random because people didn't like that, you know, the same artist would pop up back to back. So rather than having it 100% random and having the same artist potentially play over and over again, you know, up to two or three times in a row, they actually had to make it less random. Otherwise, people were complaining that it wasn't random at all. That's an example of, you know, people finding patterns when it's not there. So I do agree with you that original study seems like it had some, you know, interesting takeaways, even if the hot hand part in basketball may have been wrong.
Yeah, I think the real takeaway from that paper is that we systematically misread randomness. And that's a really costly cognitive illusion. We see patterns where they don't exist. And that's because I think it's really hard for us to understand pure randomness and to wrap our minds around it. We have evolved over the course of a very, very long time to search for patterns. Like there were rewards for this when we were foraging for materials back in the day. As Amos Tversky, the brilliant psychologist who is one of the authors of the first paper, he once said, "We invent causes to explain those patterns," and I think that's right. And so this is something that Spotify had to deal with a few years ago, and it's actually something that Apple had to deal with a few years before Spotify too. So if you make a playlist, for example, if you have a bunch of different artists on that playlist, a bunch of different songs, pure randomness means that sometimes you might hear that same song twice in a row. You might hear the same artist twice in a row, but that's not what we want from our playlist. That's not how we think about pure randomness. And so what Spotify and Apple had to do was they actually had to tweak their code and change their algorithms so that they would evenly distribute songs over the course of a playlist and evenly distribute artists over the course of a playlist. So they actually, in this very ironic, delicious, sort of absurd twist, they had to make their algorithms less random to feel more random. To me, it's this beautiful example of how we struggle to deal with randomness and how our minds can play tricks on us.
For sure. And I mean, like you mentioned, our ancestors believed in the hot hand. And you also write this in the book that monkeys and animals sometimes, they also believe in the hot hand. There were different studies done that found that. Can you kind of explain what those were all about?
Yes, this is actually one of my favorite studies of the book. It's one of the few parts of the book that are not about humans, because a great deal of this book is not just about the hot hand in basketball. It's really about the human consequences of the hot hand. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to put human faces on this psychological phenomenon. However, there are a few pages in the book about studies done in rhesus monkeys to try to figure out whether monkeys also believe in the hot hand. And they did this, these researchers, by offering them sips of cherry juice if they chose the right targets. Like, they were rewarded for believing in the hot hand or not believing in the hot hand. And what they found was that it is much easier for them to wrap their monkey brains around the hot hand belief. So this is not something that is like unique to humans. I mean, it shows that like there have been evolutionary rewards for believing in the hot hand for many years before us. And part of that is why I think we are so compelled by the hot hand. And another part of it is why we believe in the hot hand, even after we were told specifically that there is no such thing as the hot hand.
And one thing that you also touch on is that there's really no way to predict when it's going to happen, or flip that switch yourself and suddenly get hot. One of the researchers you spoke to said you can just keep producing and hope it kind of happens. You don't want to stop producing because then there's no shot of it happening, obviously. But is it true that there's no real way to predict when it's going to happen or make yourself become hot?
So I could answer this, or I could tell you what Steph Curry said when I asked him something along the same lines. And I myself would prefer to hear from Steph Curry than from me. And so I do think there are certain industries where success does lead to more success and where creativity is clustered and our hits come in bunches. Also, there are certain environments where the opposite is true, right? And you shouldn't believe in the hot hand, because believing in the hot hand can be as dangerous as it is to not believe in the hot hand. However, when I asked Steph about this a few years ago, we were talking about this game at Madison Square Garden that I think really changed his career and changed the fate of the Golden State Warriors and in some ways the future of the NBA. And I said to him, like, did you have any sense that that was going to be the day that you got hot? And he said he has no idea when it's going to happen or where it's going to happen or why it's going to happen or how it's going to happen. However, once it does happen, you have to embrace it. And to me, the tricky part and really the fun part is this inherent mystery of like figuring out when you can embrace it. But like, you know, once it happens, you have to embrace it is a really nice way of thinking about it. It's very clear. And I think it does a pretty good job of summarizing 300 pages into a few words. So, you know, what I think is like everyone should embrace it and we should try not to get burned by it.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but certain people get hot more often than others. Certain people have a hot hand more frequently. Like you and I, for example, you know, we're thinking of the last time we had a hot hand, and we're going back to high school when we were a lot younger. Steph Curry may have it happen multiple times in a season. You know, can you kind of speak to that some people have this happen more frequently and have that hot hand? And what do you attribute that to?
Well, I think I attribute it to Steph Curry being a lot better at basketball than you or me. No, I think that clearly, you know, I do not get hot in basketball. But I think that there are times in our own careers when we can get hot. And so one of the papers that that you just mentioned looked at potential hot hand periods, not among basketball players, but among movie directors and scientists and artists. And what these researchers did was they tried to put objective numbers to really subjective topics. And so these numbers are not great, like they're not perfect metrics, but they're kind of the best that we have. And so these guys looked at IMDb ratings for movie directors and auction prices for artists and Google Scholar citations for scientists. And what they were trying to figure out was if they knew what your best work is, could they also find your second or third best work? And what they found was that for many people in all of these fields, and what they think is like any field that they really looked at, your creativity happens together. Like, there are times in your career when you elevate, and those hot hand periods are what we remember and they can really not only change your career, but kind of change your life. And so, you know, it's not just basketball. Clearly, there are some people who get hot in basketball because they play basketball a lot and they're better at basketball. But, you know, Rob Reiner doesn't get hot in basketball, but I make the argument in the book that he got hot at the beginning of his directing career and it kind of changed everything for him.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Hopefully you get hot. This is the first of several New York Times bestsellers and, you know, each book is better than the last. Is that kind of when you're writing and you're thinking about all this stuff and constantly focusing on Hot Hand all day, does that seep into your thoughts like, oh, maybe this is the first of several books that I'm going to do? Or do you just try not to think about all that and block it out?
Honestly, the thought of writing three or four more books is so daunting and terrifying to me right now that I did not think about it. I did think about it at work. I mean, it's obviously easier for me to write stories for the Wall Street Journal than to pump out books. And there have been a couple times over the last few years when I did feel like I was on a roll and you know, resources became available to me. And you can imagine how this works in journalism, right? Like if you write a few stories in a row and you feel like you're on a roll, there are clearly some advantages. There are resources that become available to you that weren't there before. And I think that's really the simple power of the hot hand, which is that success kind of begets success. And so, you know, the very few times, even in journalism, when I felt like I was sort of hot, I've reminded myself that those are really the times to like hunker down and to really work a lot harder because that feeling disappears. We all know it. Like even in basketball, you could get hot and the next game out, you might not make a shot. And so it's important to embrace that opportunity once it does appear because you really never know when it's going to go away.
Right. Yeah. And like in basketball, in the moment as you're playing that game, you may think, wow, I have the hot hand. I can't miss right now. Whereas if you're in a different field, if we're talking about journalism or directing, you may not realize in that moment you have the hot hand, but then look back on a certain period of your life or a certain span and think, wow, I was killing it right then. I was hot. Is that kind of different, you know, in other walks of life than in basketball, just because maybe you don't know it as it's happening, but you can identify it later?
And it's in such an abbreviated time span in basketball, yeah. Right? I think that's one of the really alluring things about it. Like, you know, when Steph Curry gets hot, he's playing in a 48-minute basketball game. Like, if a movie director gets hot, that means that he will have churned out several hits over the course of like 5, 6, 7 years, right? And so how we think about that is actually one of the things that I am still thinking about for myself. And I think that's one of the fun parts about this book is that this is an idea, and it's an idea that has persisted for a very long time. And one of the beautiful things about the world of ideas is that you can toy around with ideas for yourself and see where you land. And there are really smart people who have thought about this for a really long time who come to opposite conclusions about the hot hand. They are on both sides of this debate. And that is sort of what I encourage readers to think about when they're reading this book. Like, I think that you can read this book with an open mind and agree with some parts of it and maybe not agree with other parts of it. And that's totally fine. Like, that's intellectually honest. And so, you know, that's, I think there are a lot of mysteries to the hot hand. And part of the fun of thinking about the hot hand is trying to solve those mysteries for ourselves.
Yeah, I like that. I agree with that. I'm a huge fan of NBA Jam, so I really enjoyed the chapter where you kind of gave the history of the game and how it blew up and became this mainstream success. And you really talk about how the hot hand kind of factors into NBA Jam. Can you kind of speak to how the hot hand is responsible for NBA Jam? And I know you mentioned the creator of NBA Jam actually uses the hot hand in every game he creates now. How is the hot hand responsible for NBA Jam success?
So one of the things I did not realize until writing this book was that NBA Jam was this monster success. Like, I grew up playing NBA Jam. I would have thought it was successful, but like, successful means that it was a game that existed like in my little town in New Jersey, right? Like, yeah. I did not know that it was one of the most lucrative games ever made. It made more than $1 billion in quarters, $1 billion in less than 1 year. It was this like complete smash hit that took everybody by surprise because it was a basketball game. And yet it was a basketball game that like really wasn't about basketball. Like, it was modeled after a sci-fi game. The game itself didn't look anything like basketball, as anyone who has played it knows, right? Like, you could somersault above the rim for, like, breathtaking slam dunks. You threw up threes from wherever on the court. It actually kind of looks like the NBA now. Like, you really just wanted to get layups and dunks or threes, which is this very funny byproduct of NBA Jam. But to me, like, the thing that always stuck out about NBA Jam was that guy who said these really funny words like boom shakalaka, right? But I think what we really wanted to hear when we played NBA Jam were he's heating up and he's on fire. And I think that the creator of the game, this guy named Mark Trammell, who happened to be a bit of a pyromaniac when he was a kid, he loved basketball and he loved video games and he loved playing with fire. I think that what Mark Trammell did was he almost single-handedly brainwashed an entire generation of impressionable young minds into believing that there was such a thing as the hot hand, right? Because part of the reason why when we played basketball, if we made two or three shots in a row, we were convinced our next shot was going in, was because we played NBA Jam. Like, that's how the world worked. And that is how we thought about the world. And, you know, Mark Trammell still thinks about the world that way to this day. He currently works for a company called Zynga, which, you know, produces a lot of the games that suck up a lot of our time on our phones. And he tries to bake the hot hand into everything he makes to this day. So if you play one of his games, the chances are if you do something three times in a row, there will be a reward for doing it a fourth time, which is a very nice way of thinking about the world. And I think that, like, he has sort of conditioned us to think about the world that way because of all the time that we have wasted playing NBA Jam over the years.
And one of those kids that was conditioned by NBA Jam was Steph Curry. His father, Del Curry, was in the game. And you talk about how he was one of those kids that was playing NBA Jam and loved it, and then maybe was conditioned to think that way. And then obviously, we know what he's done in the NBA. Did you talk to Steph about that at all, that, you know, playing NBA Jam as a kid?
I asked him if he played NBA Jam, and it was just like, Steph is 2 months older than I am, so I kind of sensed what the answer would be, and the answer was like, of course. And like, Seth Curry did an interview, I think with ESPN a couple of years ago, in which he talked about how him and Steph played NBA Jam all the time, because if you are a kid of a certain age, like, of course you played NBA Jam. Now, Steph had a good reason because Dell was in the game, but I would bet that if you were to ask most players in the NBA, maybe a couple of years ago, because some of the younger ones might not remember arcade games now, but if you were to ask players in the NBA, do you believe in the hot hand? You know, they would all say yes. Like, we have research that shows they all say yes. And did you play NBA Jam? I would imagine that almost all of them played NBA Jam, or at least were familiar with the concepts of NBA Jam, which means that they know all about the idea of the hot hand and the fact that you can be heating up and then you are on fire.
Yeah, I agree. Even if you go to like Chuck E. Cheese or certain arcades today, it's still in there. You know, younger kids or younger players even may not know, you know, all the players in the game, but I think they know of NBA Jam and probably played it. So that's a great point. At one point, you wrote about attending a meeting for a club called the Harvard Sports Analysis Collective, and you broke down the impact that Michael Lewis's book Moneyball had on the next generation of sports fans and people that want to work in sports. I totally agree with this, and can you speak on how influential that book is and how it changed the way many young people think about sports?
I think it is the way they think about sports. So that book, Moneyball, came out in 2003. And if you think about the people who are coming into the NBA now and who grow up wanting to be NBA general managers, they all read that book at a really formative time in their lives. I think there's a real delineation point here, almost like a cutoff point, between people who like remember thinking about sports and following sports and wanting to either play sports or work in sports before that book came out and after that book came out. I think that the people who came of age after that book belong to a generation that I called the Moneyball generation in the book, which is that they never had to change their mind about the way that sports works or the fact that you should like have data to root your decisions in, right? That was the way they thought about sports. It was their grounding. And I think we are seeing that now with you know, the obviously great influence of analytics on the entire world, but especially sports. And so some of the people who have written about the hot hand in the last few years belong to that generation. One of these papers was written by this team of Harvard undergraduates. So not grad not graduate students, not PhD students, not professors, but like undergrads in college dorms. And it's because the idea of using data to explore the rest of the world was not foreign to them. Like that was how they were raised. And so I went to this meeting of the Harvard Sports Analysis Collective in 2011. I was not far out of college myself, but I realized that like in those 5 years or so, the 5 year gap between me and the other people in the room, something really interesting had happened, which is that Moneyball had come out. Like I was in high school when Moneyball came out. These kids were in elementary school and middle school. And those few years made all the difference. And so, you know, one of the things I'm curious about with the Moneyball generation is how like current NBA players are going to think about data and analytics and numbers and statistics as they come into the league. Like, I think we already see that some of them are more comfortable with it than older players. I think they're used to dealing with data and having video of like everything that they do. And I think that like the effects of that is going to be something that is really interesting to watch over the next few years in the league, because these guys are going to have grown up with it. Like it won't be new to them that they're studying shot charts and like they're thinking about possessions in terms of efficiency, right? Like that is how they've thought their entire lives.
Yeah, and you have guys like LeBron James and Kevin Durant that have talked about studying analytics and wanting to be more efficient and things like that. So players that they look up to are thinking about it, which also has an impact on the next generation. I think, you know, I talked to some players about it. I know some of the older guys, like Shane Battier, for example, he wanted every single statistic and every single piece of analytics that could possibly help him get better as a player. Some players have zero interest in it, so it kind of varies. But I do agree, as this next generation gets older, and especially when their coaches, you know, because at some point our generation is going to be coaching the next generation, and I think that's where they're going to be. There's going to be more open mindedness towards analytics and towards advanced stats and things like that. Whereas I think today some of these players that come into the league, they've just been told their whole life, "Oh, that stuff's BS," and maybe they've been kind of pushed away from it. But I do think there's going to be a shift. Have you talked to any players about that in recent years, or found any players that seem to value that? Maybe young players that value those analytics more than maybe past players have?
Well, to me, the interesting guys are the guys who are in the league indirectly because of the influence of analytics on basketball, right? And some of those players are just like incredible shooters who maybe wouldn't have been valued so highly 10, 15 years ago, but there's a premium on them now, right? I mean, I wrote a story a couple months ago about Duncan Robinson, who I think is just this wonderful example of how much the game has changed. So over the course of a few years, he goes from a small high school in New Hampshire to Phillips Exeter Academy to Williams College in Division III to the University of Michigan to being undrafted to the G League to a starter for the Miami Heat and like one of the best 3-point shooters on earth, right? Like you watch him shoot and he clearly has this skill, and yet it could have been missed not too long ago. Now, you know, all the credit in the world to someone like Duncan Robinson, who has clearly worked like incredibly hard to put himself in this position. But even if he had, like, I'm not sure that he would have been valued the right way even a few years ago. And so I do think you make a really smart point about coaches using this stuff more, because we know that front offices are, and I think that we are seeing the fusion of some front offices and coaching staffs. And when you use it well, it's really powerful. Like I always think back to last year's finals of Nick Nurse just being incredibly experimental on the world's biggest stage. I mean, this guy who was toiling in the G League and in Great Britain for a really long time, the fact that he went to a box and one on Steph Curry in game three of the finals is remarkable to me. And it worked, right? Like the fact that he was able to sort of shut out the noise and overcome inertia to try new things, that is exactly, I think, what coaches should be doing. And if they work, then you should keep doing them. And if they don't work, then you don't do them. And his willingness to experiment with the entire world watching, I think, it was one of the most interesting moments in basketball, I think, over the last few years. And I'll be curious to see if more coaches start to follow Nick Nurse's lead over the next few years.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to see. And I think you're right about young people because this is just all they've ever known. They don't have to make a huge shift in their thinking away from traditional to analytics. They're just growing up with it. I think it's going to be really interesting to see how that impacts the
I mean, Alex,
NBA.
I just came from, I was at the Sloan Sports Analytics Conference this weekend, and it's just amazing to me how many young people are there, right? And they all want jobs, of course, but they're there because like this is how they think about the world. And it's really an incredible event, but you see young people who they were there in 2012 and 2013, and now they are graduating from college and working for teams, and they're going to be running teams pretty soon. And so I think like because Moneyball came out first, basketball has always been a little bit behind baseball, and we're seeing what happens in baseball now. I mean, there can be some really negative effects to thinking this way, right? And but really what we're seeing in baseball is the power of front offices and like managers having to fall in line as front offices start to dictate strategy more than ever. And I am very interested to see if that comes to basketball in a few years too. If basketball follows baseball's lead in that way, and like what type of effects it has on the entire game.
Yeah, that'll be very interesting. There's already the analytics versus traditional debate that's going on. It's a very intense one, kind of like the debate over hot hand. So we'll see how that impacts things and what the future of the league looks like. I want to ask you this. After spending so much time researching this book and interviewing different people, what was the biggest takeaway for you? What were some of the biggest things that you learned from, everything that you were doing, not just in sports and talking to people around sports, but as I mentioned, there's a lot of real life non-sports examples in this book as well. What were some of the favorite things that you learned while you were researching and talking to people for this book?
Well, all the stories, really. I mean, the narrative structure of the book is that the book is told through a bunch of big studies about the hot hand over the years, but there are stories in every chapter, and some of them have crazy and interesting and I don't know, just wonderful characters who I kind of fell in love with. And so the stories themselves, I think, were the most surprising part of the book to me because I didn't really know any of them, that and I just sort of came across them in my research and reporting, and they were really fun to write about. In terms of takeaways, like to me, the crucial distinction about the hot hand is the one about control. So when we feel that we have agency in a situation, we feel like we have the hot hand, and we can have the hot hand. But when we understand that like we're at the mercy of chance, we actually come to the exact opposite conclusion. And so I think it's important to differentiate between that skilled performance and random performance. And skilled is when you can take advantage of the hot hand, and random is when you really can't. And so I am more cognizant now of that difference between skilled performance and random performance. And I'm kind of always looking for it in my own life too.
For sure. Well, Ben, this was a fantastic book, as I mentioned, and thank you for joining me today. Let me pick your brain and talk about all your findings. It was really fun, and I definitely recommend everyone read this book.
Thank you, Alex. It was a real pleasure.
Well, if you guys want to check out this book, we have a link in our description. It is called The Hot Hand, The Mystery and Science of Streaks. Ben did a fantastic job, so make sure you check that out. And if you guys want to listen to more episodes of the Hoopsite podcast, check us out on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever your favorite podcasts are found. And until next time, thanks for listening.